Guys, welcome back to another very special episode of the Motorsport Republica. We have the great mechanic of Valentino and a whole lot of other riders, Brent Stevens. How you doing?
I'm great, thanks, mate.
Thank you for giving us your time to actually do this, because it's, you know, after a long day of you working, setting up in ASBK, and now we're back at Republica Studios, which is Best Western.
On the road again.
On the road again. So it's been great. Very excited. How's ASBK been, Brent?
Yeah, it's been pretty good. It's a, as you can imagine, it's quite a big change from what I'm used to, but it's pretty laid back, and I enjoy for the most part.
Yeah. Nice. Is it? I guess we chatted just a bit before we got rolling, but it's obviously not a full-time thing. You do other things on the side as well.
Yeah, no, I just do the racing and any testing that I got going on, stuff like that. And I've got another business that I got going, so it works out pretty good for me. Keeps my sort of finger in the door a little bit.
Keeps you ticking along.
Yeah, a little bit.
And you're riding dirt bikes, motocross, doing all that stuff as well?
Yeah, a little bit of that. Jet skiing, I'm still trying to relive my youth a little bit. I'm running out of time, but I'm milking it for all it's worth.
Yeah, that's right. What's your bike you're riding on the dirt?
I just got rid of my Yamaha 450, and I've got a couple of CR500s, so I've gone old school. So I'm up at Conondale next month. I've got a big event up there, so just riding my CR500.
Racing?
No, I'm not going to do any racing. I've done a little bit lately, but just a ride day.
How do you find riding the CR500 around?
Actually, good, to be honest. I had one when I was like 18, and I bought a whole heap of them back from America last year, and I went, gee, I was going to sell them and make a few bucks, but I decided to ride this thing, and I try to remember what it was like.
Yeah.
It was so long ago, and it's not as daunting as everyone makes out. They think it's a beast, but it's, you know, with the 450 four strokes now, they got great power, so this thing's not like it's uncontrollable.
I don't know about that. I got an old clapped out 99 RM250, and it scares the shit out of me still. Yeah. So a CR500 would be too much.
I can attest to that.
Yeah, that's all good.
Oh, that's so funny. With ASBK and everything, is it being good to be still in the paddock? Is it still enjoyable for yourself?
Yeah, it's enjoyable, because I like being at races. I miss the technical side of it, probably because of the level I was at. Even though I wasn't fundamentally making the changes over that period of time, you understand a lot.
Yeah,
you know what's going on and what changes and what the effects are and all that sort of stuff. So you already have that knowledge, but a lot of us never got to use it. And even coming here, I was hoping that I was going to be able to help a little bit in ways, but it doesn't always pan out how you think it's going to pan out. But I mean, I've just resorted to the fact that I'll just go along for the ride.
Yeah,
I still feel like I've got something to offer, but
for sure,
it's probably for the right people. I don't know.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, that's right. And look, obviously, you've got a whole lot of experience as well in the racing world. And on that, take us to how. Would love to know how you got into that whole world. Obviously, I think you're saying you started as an apprentice of Simon Crafer. How did that all even just come about?
Yeah, I know. It was pretty crazy when I think back that far ago, you know, how long ago it was. I was just I had no intention of ever going, you know, overseas with the racing sort of thing. I was just a farm boy, basically, and worked in a shop and fixed, you know, road bikes, dirt bikes, farm bikes. And actually, Simon was... He was an apprentice. I just finished my time, and he was pretty good on a bike then back in New Zealand. And he went to England and was racing super bikes. And he asked me to go over and work for him. So I just packed up and thought, oh, well, this is a pretty good opportunity. And then that was in 95 when he was riding the Honda for Rumi Honda.
Yep.
And so I did 3 years with him and followed on from there, really. Long story from that.
Yeah, well, let's get into it, because... Look, moving from obviously New Zealand, was it just moving straight over to England? Was that what you did, and was that daunting as well? Like, you know.
Yeah, it was daunting, but I was kind of young, and I went, I'm always one for an opportunity.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, a lot of people get given opportunities and don't take them, so you don't know. So now I just rented out my house, and actually the team was based in Italy, in Milan. So it was just, you know, pack up and shift over there basically. And it was pretty daunting because the team I arrived at, nobody spoke English.
That would have been a bit difficult
and
for sure.
And it was winter time because I just landed there and it was snow everywhere. And I went, God, what have I done?
That would have been a rude awakening for sure.
Yeah, it was, but the people were really hospitable, and I knew, you know, Simon and his wife were there, so yeah, a little bit of a fallback, you know.
Yeah. He's been there now for, like, since he kind of moved over, hasn't he? Hasn't he been living in Spain for 20, 30 years or something?
Yeah, he's in Andorra. He's got a house there. He's been well established there for all the obvious reasons, but he had property here still, and I think he sold it just recently.
Okay.
You know, because I think he had intentions of coming back, but then, you know, his kids have gone to school and they've all grown up, and he's been there that long now. He's probably been in Europe more time, longer than he has been in Australia, really.
Yeah, probably. I think we had a chat to him when we were at the Aussie Grand Prix, Daniel. He's saying he's been in Spain, I think, longer than almost in New Zealand or Australia, whatever it
quite
is.
A while.
You know? Sure. And then did you follow him to the Grand Prix paddock? Is that how it kind of worked?
Yeah, we did those 3 years with Superbikes. It was 1 year with Honda and 2 years with Kawasaki.
Yeah.
And then he had the opportunity to go to the Grand Prix with the Red Bull 500 I think might have been with Gary. I'm not quite sure. McCoy.
Yeah, I think they were teammates. Yeah.
And I decided to pull the pin and went back to New Zealand.
Yeah, right.
And obviously didn't go that year. But then one of the mechanics that I worked with the 3 years with Simon was Mike Webb, Kiwi guy.
Yep.
And he was the technical director now, and even more so now, with Erta and Dorna. He's quite high up. And he called me up and said, look, hey, Wayne Rainey has stopped the racing with the team. He's pulled out. We've still got a 500 team. It's going to be Carlos Checa and Max Biaggi. And they're based in Amsterdam. And he said, we need somebody to come over and be part of the team. Do you want to come? And I went, I just moved to Australia, actually. And I hummed and hawed over it. And he goes, just come over for the 2 weeks. We'll build all the race bikes. And you decide if you want to stay, we'll pay you. If you want to go, whatever. And I just went, I hadn't quite ticked all the boxes, you know, done the Superbike and walked away from the Grand Prix the first time. I thought I'd better not do it the second time. So moved over there and worked for Carlos Checa and the Factory 500 team.
That's so cool.
Yeah, that would have been an experience for sure. What was he like to work with, Carlos?
He was great. He was he's a great guy, really, is. He tries hard and was good fun. Crashed too much.
Like, yeah, there was a bit of that, wasn't there?
That first year in 99, we had the record for the crashes.
Oh, really?
We had 28 crashes or something. So I figured that if I can last a year with Carlos crashing bikes, you know, he'd crash three in a day, you know, testing.
And it's more work for you, I guess, as well, isn't it?
it's a lot of work. He crashed one in Japan, went 99, drove it into the wall and the thing caught on fire. And I just remember, here we go. You know, so I mean, you get thrown under the bus a little bit, and you go, well, if I can come out of that, I'll be right.
You'll be right on the other side, definitely.
Yeah, that's full on. Have you had over years? I guess it's a broad question, but you know, with Carlos, are you work? How often are you working through the night to get the bike ready? Is it pretty often, or is everything pretty just quick just to get another bike ready?
To be honest, back in those days, the 500 was a little bit more because it always felt like you had, I don't know, maybe it was just because we had so many crashes, it felt like I was there all the time. But you know, in the later years with the MotoGP and stuff like that, you're very rarely there later than like 7 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and the target is always to have two race bikes.
Yeah.
You don't come in the morning and go, okay, we're going to finish off what we didn't finish. You leave the garage at night with two race bikes in there for the next morning.
Yeah.
And that runs through to the day as well. Like, you crash in the first practice, you just work your butt off until you got two bikes there. And it's the cool thing in that environment is that many a time, in Yamaha all those years I was there, if Valley had a crash or Lorenzo or somebody, you get your job. Like, your primary job is to fix your rider's bikes, and then would miss lunch and would jump over and help the other guys.
Oh, okay, right.
And vice versa.
I mean,
I remember that some of the best times were, I know it sounds crazy to talk about crashes being the best times, but as a mechanic, that's when you come to your fore, you know. I remember, like, we're pushing Valley out into the qualifying and stuff like that, and we're just trying to slap a sticker on the cowling on the way out, and we've had, like, six guys working on the bike for, like, an hour and a half, you know.
God, it, and you see it on TV as well, and it seems like everyone just kind of knows what they're doing, and it's just so robotic and mechanical of what they have to do in their job.
It's honestly incredible how fluid it is, and even with three guys that you're not working with all the time, because basically in the team there's three mechanics. There's a data guy, and there's a suspension guy. So, I mean, you guys could be three of you working on the bike, and you just – everybody knows everything what on the bike, but naturally you just – sometimes you're better at something than the other guy.
Mm.
So in that pressure cooker, you just naturally gravitate to the thing that you know you can do quicker.
Yeah.
And that's – and it's, no one gets offended by it. Yeah. You just leap in and, okay, I'll pick up – I'll do that.
Yeah.
You know, and you can have – you can be working on a bike. You can have four guys, five guys, and you can be doing something, and you can see in your peripheral vision – that someone's doing something else, and you know that you've got the tool right in front of you, and you can just pass it to him.
Mm. Yeah, okay.
He doesn't bump into you. And then we've talked about this many times with my mate Alex. You get a data guy in there, and he's like that guy you don't want in there. You know, there's six of us could be working, and one guy comes
just
in there
lingering around
to unplug a stroke sensor, and his arms are wider than a 747, and you just go, what the?
Yeah.
You know, it's just crazy because he's not used to working on the bike. And he's just jumped out of his computer and trying to help, and he ain't helping.
You're making it worse a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's crazy. Was it, excuse my ignorance, but you're like the closest, I guess, person I've spoken to that's been such in-depth in MotoGP, so I've got 1,000 questions lined up for you.
Yeah, you hit me with them.
With like the old two strokes, what was the data like? Was it still really in depth? Obviously, it's been different to MotoGP. Was it still quite in depth? Like, were people still plugging in computers to those bikes, or was it really analog?
It's funny because I think, but that's a long time ago. That was like 25 years ago.
I was only like four or five years old, but you know,
exactly. No, there was for sure, but not to the level they are now.
Yeah,
not at all. I mean, the whole bike is. It's won and lost really on the data and the computers. You know, that wasn't the case then.
Mm.
I mean, here's an example. I think about how all the bikes now, you know, they've got center mounted fuel tanks and all that sort of stuff, you know, trying to keep the balance right on the bike. They don't want the bias to change too much. We had 25 liter tanks, and they were forward of the pivot of the bike between the right in front of the riding. Do you imagine how much the weight changes during a 20-lap race when you got 25 litres there and at the end of the race you got nothing?
Yeah. I mean,
those guys that rode the things back then were just animals because our guys couldn't jump on that and do that now.
Mm.
They would just bitch and complain about everything on it. Really.
Yeah, I understand that. That's incredible. I've never really thought about that. But, yeah, it makes sense. Yeah. And then you've got the two-stroke 500 power to weight ratio as well, and you see like high sides back then was almost a norm, wasn't it, compared to now?
Well, yeah, you didn't have the traction control that you got now and all that sort of stuff. It was all in your throttle in your hand, you know. And that's the thing I think Valley was really, really good at when he was at his best on the 500. He had great throttle control. A lot of guys didn't, but you know, and as a progression went to the four strokes, they came a little bit easier to ride, and then all the electronics and blah blah blah. You know, I guess the first thing was, remember everybody when Casey was going so good, they were saying how good the electronics are. He just opens up the throttle in the corner and just opens it wide up.
That's fine.
I don't know whether it was ever that good, but you know, I mean, he was a master of the throttle as well.
Mm.
Yeah, definitely, and you could see that especially around Phillip Island as well. Like,
yeah, exactly.
I don't think anyone ever got close to him there. Out of what, he had like 11 wins there or something?
Yeah,
ridiculous.
7 or 8, 11 wins, whatever it was,
That's crazy.
He pretty much owned that place, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, even like taking it back further, the superbikes would have been even more bare bones.
Yeah, 100%, yeah. I mean, yeah, they didn't seem like they had any electronics on those things at all, you know.
Just all rider.
Yeah, all rider. Well, look at, rest in peace, Anthony.
Yeah,
Cobra, you know, like, I mean, he was just a freak, wasn't he?
Wasn't he? That was probably the golden age of World Superbikes, that too, that 90s to early 2000s.
Yeah, that was really fun. It was a great time to be involved in it because you had Colin Edwards, Troy Corsa, you know, there was Simon, Aaron Slight. I mean, it was just really great times.
Yeah, stacked field.
Yeah, it was, and it was fun too.
Yeah.
You know, like everything now is just, it's like life in general is so serious. Yeah. You can't do anything untoward anywhere, but I mean, there was big parties in the pits. It was great.
It would have been pretty loose, I reckon.
A couple of those folks would have gone pretty hard, I reckon.
Oh, yeah.
That's what it's about.
I don't know how many stories you want to elaborate.
I'm not going there.
Patreon episode.
Yeah, that's right. Even we went to Superbikes this year and we go to MotoGP every year and whatever. But even then, like, you can see how much more corporate MotoGP is compared to even World Superbikes these days. World Superbikes is still a lot more relaxed, where GP is like, you know, everyone's on the go all the time. You know, it's full on.
Yes, it's changed a lot, and you see that a lot over the years. As a mechanic, you're always very vocal on that, because for the whole time I've been a mechanic, 25 years in racing, you have the same guys in the garage doing all the on the coal face. You've got the same guys, you know, you just walk outside and just go, wow, it's stacked out here. You've got another PR person, you got another PA for the PA, you know, for the, you know, for the...
Yeah, person or, on person work for this.
Yeah,
person,
and just go, wow, we can't even get a pay rise. You know? And our argument was, all, if you spend more money in the garage and we win, all of you guys, you don't even need to be here, because if you start winning races, everyone's going to come to you and you don't have to go to them with a story.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, but they just corporate world. They think completely different to what a mechanic does, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
You go.
Oh, I was going to say, what was it like going through all that phase? Like, how did you guys tackle that, I guess, as a team of mechanics and as a team as a whole?
I don't know about a team as a whole, but as a mechanic, I didn't enjoy it very much.
Yeah.
I think I got in trouble quite a few times.
Okay.
Because I'm just honest, I want to win races, and you putting out a post about something that's actually bullshit, that doesn't help us win, you know?
Mm.
And it's a funny old world, mate. I look at Formula One, and you know, you see all those behind the scene series now, which are a really great eye opener, but things aren't always how they look.
Yeah.
Trust me, you know, you think you've always got the best of the best of the best. Yeah, you still got people with personalities.
Mm.
And that's a huge part of where you get, because if someone's got an agenda or someone's got ideas, I know it's not a democracy in racing, because you've entrusted in somebody to make the right decisions. It's not always the right person.
Mm.
You know, so often things can go wrong or go down a rabbit hole, and it can be one person's decisions, you know, because someone's been entrusted to make those decisions. But you know, but when you think about development of race bikes and stuff, it's not really one person. It's more, you know, because there's so many parts to it. But as far as like making decisions on track, you know, you've entrusted in one guy to make the right decisions, you know.
Mm.
So it's an interesting world, mate. I like a bare roots way more than I do all the corporate stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm old school.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, you were in the paddock for such a long time, you would have seen like a vast amount of changes from, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, whatever it is, to 20... When did you finish up? 2016, 17, something like that? 2019?
Or 2020, I can't remember.
Yeah, 2020.
Last year, the Valley was at the factory team.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they hardly had any hospitalities. I mean, you think now we have like Yamaha had five semi-trailers, and it's just a show now. You know, and we're always, all the Ducati guys are always getting the old hospitalities from Formula One, so they're multi-level, and it's just mind-blowing, the money that's spent at the back of the garage.
And I suppose that's stuff we wouldn't see here in Australia. It'll all be mostly the European circuits that...
Oh, yeah, if you ever get a chance, you got to go to European race when all the transport is there and the hospitality is its next level.
Yeah, it would be.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
What do you think of Phillip Island when you go there? Because you obviously go to Europe and all that, and like Phillip Island's pretty old school and bare. We always talk about it's pretty bare bones.
Yeah, you did right. Whenever we came here, we go, this is one of the most beautiful tracks in the world, but it's one of the shittiest facilities. Yeah. And the only place that even matched that was Donington. But Donington had one of the best tracks in the world.
Yeah.
But really crappy facilities. That's where we went to Silverstone. But then you get all the fancy stuff at Silverstone, but no one really likes the track quite as much as Donington, you know, because it was undulating and everything like that. But now I'm doing doing Aussie Superbikes.
Oh.
Phillip Island's the best one. We go to Morgan Park, and it's like a dirt paddock. So what? I've seen it all. you just change your level of acceptance.
Yeah, true.
Because this weekend's pretty, as far as I'm aware, the track's pretty basic. There's only five or six corners, or it's a pretty short track, pretty flat.
Yeah, it's a pretty basic track, this one. I don't think anyone really, really loves it.
Mm.
And they've spent a bit of money on the garages and stuff, which is good.
Okay, that's
good. At least it's a bit more upmarket like that. But yeah, the tracks, it's a shame we go to these tracks that aren't that great, you know. I mean, I know we're going to have variety. We don't go to Darwin anymore because of, obviously, for the cost and everything like that, which is a shame, because that was a great event, especially when we had the supercars.
Yeah, that was great.
Last year, that was awesome.
Yeah.
It was really good. Don't go to Tassie anymore. We go to Morgan Park, which is, oh, I mean, the tracks, it's a tricky track, but facilities are really, you know, not that great. But, you know, I think it would be nice to have maybe more races at the Bend, maybe Phillip Island. I mean, even if we had just those three tracks and utilize them a bit more, because at least they're great facilities, you know.
Yeah,
exciting tracks, but anyway, it is what it is.
Yeah, that's it. And like, you know,
I think we just in general need more races, because we only have 7 rounds, and I think it's difficult to have. You can find a champion in 7 races. Don't get me wrong, but you've got all these guys that are training, and we start early, finish late, and there's such big gaps in between the season. If I had to try and recommend, I'd have the race of the season shorter. And throw in a couple more races, like try and get 9 races, but in 8 months rather than 11 months or 10 months.
Span it out. The breaks are kind of ridiculous, aren't they?
Well, it's just you got guys trying to stay fit,
you
know, over a long period of time, and you got 6 weeks where you're doing nothing. You're not even on a bike, you know. So it's hard work for everybody, for sure.
100%. Yeah, and then look, there's I guess ASBK does need a lot of work in that sense. We definitely don't claim to know the answer, but it does need a change, and those brakes is definitely one of them. You know, needs a whole lot more racing.
100%.
I think they can do it. They just maybe they need more input from more people. I don't know whether everybody's haven't got ideas or not forceful enough in suggesting them. Because I mean, for what reasons they do it that long, I got no idea. You know, you could have it over a summer series.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, we start at the end of summer and finish at the beginning of summer. So we're dealing with a little bit crappy weather.
Yeah.
I mean, in a perfect world, you'd start racing in September and finish in March and have it over summer.
That'd be perfect.
That's a good point.
I mean, I understand the logistics and, you know, holidays and all that sort of stuff is hard. But, you know, we fundamentally race in the in winter.
Yeah, it's a good point though. People are off, kids are off school as well at the same time. It gives them an excuse to go down to Phillip Island.
Yeah, it might draw some more crowd numbers.
Yeah,
you never know.
Yeah, it's a good point that you make, actually.
I don't know. I'm full of ideas, man.
Get you the head of Dorna, no worries. Liberty Media now.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, what do you think? What do you make of that?
I don't really know. I was surprised that they sold it. I mean, I know they didn't sell it outright, all of it, but I don't know. I don't know whether it was just a money thing or whether they think that somebody else can do a way better job. I mean, I know they've got different ideas and stuff like that. I mean, I think Dorna were doing a pretty good job. I don't agree with them increasing all the – I mean, it's different now they're not involved in it, but being involved in it, I just didn't know why they just wanted to keep having more and more races like Formula One, because it was – everybody was getting burnt out.
Yeah.
I know a lot of mechanics, they're still in – you get used to it and you put up with it, but it's just the season's way, way too long.
Yeah.
You know, and when it went, it got listed on the stock exchange or whatever it did, then it became a big business. They had to answer to shareholders, so they had to make more money. So more races makes more money, blah, blah, blah. But end of the day, everyone's got to go with the races, you know, 22 races or whatever they got, or 21. Yeah. It's a bootload of.
It's a massive calendar. 44 races, 22 rounds.
Yeah, and that's what they're even throwing in the sprint races.
Yeah, that's
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess everybody's got used to that as well, but no one really wanted it. As a punter now that I'm outside of it, I think it's great.
Yeah.
I love the format of it.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing that makes me even watch Formula One, because it's a little bit exciting for a short period of time.
But, yeah.
But I hate to be involved in it.
Yeah. It makes sense. And, like, look, with Liberty Media as well, like, they took over F1, and I think they bought them for $4 billion, similar to what MotoGP is now. And now they're worth $40 billion or something crazy. Like, it's
crazy money, isn't it?
It's crazy money. But the fan involvement that we see, we went to the Oz Grand Prix, and like a Friday in 2017, whatever it is, we'll be on a stand and it would be empty. We'd be the only ones in there. And now Friday in the Formula One at Albert Park sold out. Like, it's The fans are mental.
What's a draw card? Can anyone tell me what the draw card is to that?
Because drive to survive, and knowing.
I don't get it.
Yeah, it's drive to survive and knowing people's personalities. You know, they get an insight to Daniel Ricciardo, for example.
Yeah.
And I guess that's why Valentino, and you probably tested this as well, was so successful, because he was that personality. And that's why, you know, and you see a lot of riders or Spanish riders are quite robotic.
Yeah.
But, you know, Valentino was always
out there,
different, running in the toilets after he won a race, whatever it was.
Celebrations.
Yeah. He had some charisma, didn't he?
Definitely. And then I think with Netflix, it helps bring that out of people, or they maybe even manipulate it a little bit.
Yeah.
And then that's why we were there, and people were more interested just seeing the driver than the actual cars going past.
Yeah, I think it's because it's so high profile. It's a bit like a Hollywood superstar. You know, sometimes you want to see the person and you don't really care about the racing.
That's it. And it's all about, like you said, high profile for themselves as well, to say, oh, look where I'm at. You know, it's a big social thing now to be at an F1 race.
Oh, for sure, yeah. Yeah, you're 100% right. I mean, I still wouldn't pay, but anyway, it's all good. There's plenty of people that do. Yeah.
There is. There definitely is. Going from two strokes to four strokes, what was that like as a change as a mechanic for yourself? Was it something you're in favour for?
I don't really – well, I guess because I came from superbikes, I knew what was involved.
Yeah, good point.
And when we were going to four strokes, they said, well, okay, we've got limited engines. You got 12 engines for the year sort of thing. It was a lot more than what they have now probably. And there was probably – and I guess in our minds we thought, oh, well, there's going to be a lot less work. But thinking about the two strokes, I mean, and my mates that we used to work on them were tested this. It was – working on the 500s was great, you know, like cause we built them.
Mm.
You know, like you'd on a Thursday when you do the setup in the garage, you'd prep all the bikes, and then in the afternoon you'd build a race engine, put the cranks in, all that sort of stuff, get ready so that on Saturday night you put a brand new engine in. And that was good fun, you know. And then when we got the four strokes, you think, oh, well, we're not going to be doing that. But then it got to this point where all you're doing is changing engines all the time. I mean, I remember one year we did like 120 engine changes over a year because you're completely rotating them around, you pull them out. And because they could service them, so they'd pull them out and you'd arrive the next morning and put the engines back in again. And you'd think that, okay, four-stroke, the power on a four-stroke's a broader spread of power, although we won't be changing gearboxes very often. We just did just as many gearbox changes because we're trying to get the optimum out of it. So the workload didn't get less, and you'd think it would. It just became possibly a little bit less enjoyable if you were mechanically minded, you know, because you, as a mechanic, you like to be hands-on, you like to do stuff. That's where you get the buzz from, you know. A little bit like when you crash a bike, you know, you got to get it going and work to your peak. So it was sort of like thrown into it, although I sort of knew it before, but it was different. I mean, we knew it was going to happen because there's a lot of talk about it coming out of America that they didn't want two strokes and all that stuff, but yeah, it is what it is now.
It's definitely taken over now, and I don't think they're ever going back to two strokes.
That'd be nice.
So you hear a lot of talk about it. You listen to Travis Pastrana, and he goes, you know, they jumped the gun too early, you know, because, I mean, when you think about the pollution from two strokes and stuff, it ain't as bad as what they were made out.
Yeah, correct.
You know, they've built outboard motors, you know, that were really economical and all that sort of stuff, but, you know, they got on a bandwagon. It's like lots of stuff, you know, it goes down a line, you just can't go back.
The thing, isn't it?
So, and they're still making 300 EXEs, and KTM and Yamaha are still making two strokes as well. Like,
exactly right. So it's not like they were dead and buried.
Yeah.
And they obviously still sell plenty of them.
Yeah, they still fly out the doors, to what I'm aware of.
100%. I worked for KTM for a bit, and I'm telling you, the 300s outsold everything.
Yeah, exactly. So there's still some life in the old two stroke.
Eh? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Good fun.
Good fun. Don't know about a CR500 though. I'm scared the shit out of me.
I just better make a comment on that.
I'd jump on it, but I'll probably end up in a hospital bed.
You get arm pumped when it's just idling, I reckon.
Come and have a ride anytime you want.
Yeah, done. We'll take you up on that.
Sign me up. That's awesome.
Hey guys, it's James from Motorsport Republica. Just want to give a shout out to HJC Australia. They have a brand new helmet coming out, the R412. Make sure you head down to your local dealer to check it out. It's got max defogging, four intakes, three exhaust vents. It comes with four different shell sizes and five different liners. It's got lift force and drag force reduced, optimized air ventilation. This helmet is an awesome new street helmet. Make sure you check it out. Go to hjc.com. Go to your local dealer and you better grab yours today. Thanks.
Talk us through 04. Rossi comes across to Yamaha. What was the hype like? Did you have any sort of inkling before that he was coming? How was that whole transition period for yourself and the team?
That's interesting. I've told the story quite a few times, but because I was working with Yamaha,
yeah,
and with Carlos, and I knew all the Honda guys, like Jeremy yeah, Burgess Jeremy and Alex and all them, and they'd always beat us and they'd give me a ribbon all the time. Then I'd be on the plane with them coming back to Australia because we flew home all the time.
So you're it all the time.
And I actually went to JB and I said, look, JB, if anybody ever leaves HRC down there,
hit me up, yeah.
Yeah, hit me up. And it was probably a year later, he gave me a call and he says, Brent, don't go anywhere. It seems like we're coming to you.
Wow.
And which nobody, you know, I mean, Mick talked about it. Nobody ever did that sort of thing. And I was, well, this is a bit of a pie in the sky. I don't know whether this will actually happen. And because I was working for Carlos at that stage and Max was leaving, so it did eventuate. And I said, JB said, we're bringing a lot of guys, but we need somebody there that knows the bike. We know you. We want you to work on with Valentino. Perfect. So I said, well, you're just going to have to talk to the management and get me to move from Carlos to Valentino and find a replacement for me there. I said, that's up to you. So all that happened and he came across and it was pretty exciting times and he was great. I mean, it was such exciting times. I mean, we'd battled and worked hard, you know, for all those years on the 500 and Max has had some okay results, but it wasn't like we were dominant and Carlos was always kind of there, kind of not crashing and stuff. But to think that Valentino was coming, I mean, globally, it was massive news, wasn't it?
It was the biggest thing.
And it was crazy because he couldn't test the Yamaha at Valencia because HRC held him to the day.
Yeah.
And then it was only at, I think, Malaysia, Sepang, when he first finally got to throw his leg over.
Yeah, I remember turning up there in Malaysia and we go, what are we going to wear? And he came out with all this VR stuff, all this yellow switches, and we just turned them inside out. it was bizarre. But yeah, it was exciting. I remember that first test really, really well. And jumped on the bike and JB made such big changes to improve the bike that first test. You know, it was, I guess the changes that we made to that were the changes we were hoping we were going to make to the Ducati. It didn't happen, but, you know, I went, wow, this, and even though he was happy with the changes we made and we made really good progress, the bike was still, wasn't a winner at that stage, you know. But Yamaha put a big effort in. I mean, they put massive effort, had all the right guys and smart guys too, you know. And, you know, to go to that first race was, I don't think anyone was expecting that.
Oh, no way.
No.
And the irony of beating Max, who went to Honda. Yeah, his Italian arch rival.
On his bike.
Yeah. Isn't that like a story that will just go down for ages?
Well, yeah, and I mean, everybody talks about how, I say, arrogant Honda can be and have been, and it was just like an extra boot in the butt, wasn't it?
Oh,
they would have hated it.
And, you know, letting go of the most marketable man in motorcycle racing ever.
For Max.
There's a lot of arrogance.
Yeah. And then what he did on the Yamaha afterwards. When you talk about those changes of what Jeremy did, what's an example of a type of change that he would make that would make Valentino or anyone go faster? What would he change to the bike?
Oh, in this particular case, I remember it because it's, I mean, if you have to be kind of reasonably technical to understand it, but he had trouble stopping the bike, you know, but the bike was so low that you didn't get any pitching effect front and rear, you know. So if you imagine trying to stop a go-kart with front brakes with suspension, if you're too low, you don't have that. He just came in and he said, okay, let's just change this. And we made a big step. And I remember Valentino coming in going, oh, my God, that has transformed this bike.
Yeah, wow.
And one thing, just with basically Jeremy understanding his comments and knowing, you know,
what to do.
First things to try, you know. I mean, we tried other things, but he just went, oh, we need to do that.
Yeah.
And from there on in, it was just like gun ho, you know. And there was a lot of other things, you know, they had a lot of problems with the engines and the electronics and that, because everyone was experimenting with, because it was the beginning of the four stroke, and they were, the four strokes had so much engine braking.
Yeah.
You know, yep. You imagine shutting down the throttle and the back starts locking up.
Yeah.
So everyone was experimenting with slipper clutches and,
yeah.
And then using the throttles to stop the slippage of the rear wheel and all that sort of stuff. So it was really interesting times, but yeah, I got to take my hat off. At that time, Yamaha had some really good guys, and the guy that was leading the project, he just would not take no for an answer as far as getting somewhere, and probably what they've lost now at the moment.
That's fascinating.
It's strange. Like you said, Yamaha poured everything into it when he came across, yet now they're sort of not really doing it. Well, from the outside, it doesn't seem like they're doing that.
Yeah, it's hard to know how much effort they're putting in. I'm sure they're putting in an effort, but I was thinking about this when I was driving home tonight, because I thought for sure you guys are going to go down this
rabbit hole.
I was paying $1.01 on sports bet, I reckon.
A little bit. And I think about why Yamaha are at the point they are and why Honda are at the point they're at. And it's not, I mean, Ducati and Aprilia and KTM, being European, they've always seemed more open-minded to explore different avenues, try different stuff. And it's not that Yamaha or Honda didn't put enough money in, or they haven't got smart enough guys, but they're very closed in as far as they want to do everything themselves. Japanese.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They don't want to have somebody else from somewhere else doing their job.
That's right.
Or get more information. They've been forced to now. And you only see it now, but it's too late now.
That's right.
They've got a real rocky road ahead. I mean, this has taken 5 years to really manifest into, like, they are not good enough.
Yeah.
And it's certainly going to take another 5 years for them to come out of this. It's not, there's no easy fix. There's no easy quick fix, because while they've been sitting on their hands, all these European companies have been working really hard on aerodynamics, electronics, all that stuff, and they've just been feeding off the best they can get, you know, whether it be Formula One technology, or look at the aero.
Yeah.
That all came from Ducati, from Formula One, from Ferrari. So, I mean, all those things, I mean, they'll get there. It's a big cycle. Mm. You know, I mean, Yamaha and Honda dominated for so long, and Ducati were nowhere.
Yes,
that's right.
People forget that.
So yeah.
We'll have this conversation in 10 years, and someone else will be,
Honda,
we'll be back. They might be back. But for the foreseeable future, it's going to be tough.
Yeah, I guess until the change, maybe in 2027, whatever it is, if someone can get a leg up there, it's kind of a bit more of a level playing field again. I think they're going down to 900s or 800s.
800s again.
Yeah, 800s again. So
does anyone know the reason for that? I mean, you'd think once you've done it once, you'd be a little smart on what's going on, right? Don't tell me it's because they want to slow the bikes down.
No.
Because they've already been down that road, mate. Smaller bikes go around corners faster than big ones, so I don't know what they're trying to do here. It just seems crazy.
Yeah.
Absolute crazy philosophy.
Yeah.
I think it's got to do with all that using biofuel and all that kind of woke stuff.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. You can go into it. It's all right. We're pretty out there, this podcast.
No, we do some silly stuff, really. I mean, we've already done this. We've been there and done that, and it costs manufacturers millions of dollars to achieve nothing.
Yeah.
Basically, we redevelop bikes and trying to make them more economical on fuel. And because you had to try and get the same horsepower of a smaller thing, you had to design better pistons, better conrods, and it just costs so much. And it didn't fix what they were set out to, because you've got to have a target of what you're trying to achieve, right? Otherwise, you're just bumbling along doing nothing.
That's right. It's pointless.
I mean, do you want to save money? Is it just about fuel? Or do you want to go slower? Well, there's heaps of ways of doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Well, how long did the 800s last? It was 07 to 11?
Yeah, I think it was only a couple of years. It wasn't
a couple
long.
Of years.
It wasn't long, was it?
Scrapped
it wasn't
pretty quickly.
Even 11, yeah.
It wasn't a great time, if I remember.
I don't think the racing was that great back then. I think it was all pretty spread out. It wasn't super tight, close battles that I can really remember compared to, you know, 2013 kind of onwards, or back when they were at the thousands.
Yeah.
Well, I think the thousand era is definitely the best one, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, by far.
Maybe they're doing all the changes just to try and equalize Honda and Yamaha a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe because they've been down that road before.
Yeah.
Maybe they got the R and kind of got the R&D to help a little bit. Could be.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe.
They just got to strip. Oh, we keep going on about stripping back aero. You've seen no aero. You've seen a little bit of aero as well. What? Where do you stand on it?
I don't really like it, to be honest. Okay. I mean, my gut feeling is I remember when it came in and they came out with a set. I mean, how I understand it, Ducati tested it at Mugello because it was fast straight, yeah, and it's got a little bit straight. Of rise, and yep. they messed around with that and it had some advantage, and then all of a sudden they're using it because the rules allowed it, and everybody got on it, and everybody had standard cowlings or bodywork, and then they had one set of clip-on bodywork, I mean wings, and they were pretty rudimentary back then, yeah. for sure. And it just snowballed, like, just out of control, you know, because if you think about it, you've got aero pulling the bike down right when you're going fast, but to a certain degree, it must make the bike slower to change direction because you're making the bike heavier. And there was quite a few times at the beginning when we went down the road of just having it on all the time. We had the chance to have it off, and a few of us thought that it would be better off to start the weekend with it off. And if you have a situation where you need it,
just put it on,
utilize it.
Mm.
But I just got to but in saying that, you had to make some small changes with the suspension when you had it on because it was more downforce. So
yeah,
you had to put a little bit more preload on the forks or something like that.
Yeah, makes sense.
But it just went to the stage where the following year, well, that's just standard now. We've got that. We've got another set. So, and then it just went on and on and on and on. I mean, I understand the development of everything like that, but I don't know where you stop and start with all this sort of stuff. I mean, I thought it was better with it. I thought it was better without it, me personally.
Yeah, I agree. We're the same.
Yeah, yeah, we definitely agree with that.
The bikes look better.
Bikes do look better without the aero.
Well, you're not selling a model as such, are you? You're selling a brand name for sure. It's Ducati or Monster or whatever you're selling. Mm. So, I mean, you can't even relate those things. But in saying that, you look at street bikes now and they've got wings on them. You're like the Ducati's
street bike.
Okay. Holy smoke, do we really need that on there? I don't think so.
Well, it's funny, you know, you can buy a little CF Moto 150s and they have wings on them just for show. Oh
my God, what's going on?
It's a strange place. It's a strange time we're living in.
It is, eh? Oh, don't even get me started with that.
Oh, come on, we'll get you one for your birthday or something like that. You can race around on the CF Moto.
Just get me a wing.
Just the one. What was it like working in such a high-performing environment with Valentino and the likes of JB and all the boys? It must have just been such a ecstatic feeling, I guess, or like when you're winning so much and performing and being so fluid, as you mentioned before, in that environment.
Yeah, it's you understand a little bit more when you're out of it, to be honest, because I mean, a lot of people I knew were in it and got out of it and maybe not lucky enough to be where I was with Valentino, but you're so deep into it. I mean, there'd be, heaps of mornings, days, sessions. There'd be six camera crews, like, constantly outside your garage filming for different broadcasts and that. And it's amazing how you manage to block all that out.
Mm.
And just because you got to focus on your job, you know. And we still had fun. We were larrikins, to be honest. We'd joke all the time on the radios and stuff. And we tried to make it as lighthearted as you could considering the situation. But it's... You feel the pressure, you don't feel the pressure. I won't say you become immune to it, but it's really hard to describe that one, to be honest, you know, from a mechanical point of view, for like working involved in it. Yeah, I mean, you really enjoy it, and the highs were really highs, you know, but you got so used to it that, I mean, there's weekends when we finish second, we go, what the hell did we do wrong?
Yeah, well.
How do we not win?
Yeah.
I mean, that wasn't arrogance, but it was like, we were good enough to win and we didn't. What went wrong?
What's happened,
what did we miss out on? And I mean, the Aussie guys, they were pretty confident guys, you know, coming from where they went with Honda and with Mick and stuff like that.
Of course.
We had a song we'd play every time we'd win. It was like, we are the champions, you know. We'd just play it as loud as we could right through all the characters could hear it. I
would have hated you guys.
Oh, exactly, you know. But, I mean, you just got to live for the moment.
Yeah.
Well, that's it.
Because there was weekends we'd crash and you just go, well, you just got to And JB always just say, live by the sword, die by the sword.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, live the moment.
Yeah.
And he was dead right. You know, there was times when we just dominated, then other times when we really struggled, you know, later on. But, you know, everybody has their day.
That's true.
And it doesn't last forever. I mean, when you were in it, I never saw the end.
Mm.
I just never saw it. It was just like every weekend, you know, you think 11 wins and you felt like you just couldn't do any wrong.
Yeah, you just go more
to,
and more,
to a,
more.
To a certain degree. And it wasn't just because the bike was so good. I mean, Valentino in his peak was just phenomenal.
Yeah, and I don't think the bike was the greatest either. I think back then especially it was 80% rider, wasn't it? You know, jumping on that Yamaha proved that.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, he made the difference. I mean, David Abbrivio, he was the one that got Valentino there.
He's a genius too.
Yeah.
I mean, Yamaha would never have won those titles unless he'd, you know, had a close enough relationship to get Valentino, because he was the right guy for it. And he wanted it as bad as everybody else did, you know, because he wanted to prove Honda that they wasn't the bike, it was him, you know.
Yeah.
And kudos for him.
How good's that? Well, it's as good as it's ever going to get, that story, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you won't get another story like that.
I don't think so.
No.
No way. What's Valentino like? How in-depth does he go into learning the bike and what you guys do and everyone around him does?
He's really technical.
Okay.
Yeah, sometimes in the later years, technical to a detriment to him.
Yeah, right.
A little bit. And he was very thorough, really honest. I mean, he came into the garage and he was – you only see – if you see how he prepared himself, you know, he'd wiggle his ear and touch his balls, jump on the bike. I mean, he had a system in place. And that's how he ran. He was very methodical about what he did. Liked to have a good laugh and stuff like that. But he worked really hard, and it became, I think, a lot harder with the technology coming along, because then everybody had to spend more time looking at data, overlaying stuff. There's so much more stuff, that more involvement in it. I mean, he was a carrot. He'd always be late. He'd turn up late. He'd leave everybody waiting for him.
All that's Italians, mate. That's Italians, I'm telling you. I know from Daniel.
But yeah, and exactly. But yeah, really.
Oh, my bad.
So he is on time tonight because of you.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Anyway, but Valentino, he'd milk that. He'd turn up late just to show his stature, you know. And kudos to him for doing that. But, I mean, yeah, he was great to work with. He really was.
Yeah.
Well, super nice to everybody, and but very, very professional.
Yeah, and it's funny you say that. I was just going to ask what he was like to work with, because you hear stories of what Philip Oddle told us is the famous story of Michael Schumacher. He knew every mechanic's birthday, you know, and just those small things, and like that make a big difference in, realistically, it's a team sport, you know, and you need to get along. And you obviously, as he said, you don't want to work for an arsehole. You want to work for someone who appreciates you and still has that support, and you can see that as well.
Yeah, no, he was definitely like that. I mean, there's always that element of communication. I mean, he spoke good English, even though people say it doesn't sound like he does, but he's way better than my Italian. But there's always going to be a closer relationship between him and the Italians and the team and stuff like that. But he was always really nice to us, you know, like when we never lived in each other's pockets or something. We'd go out for dinner maybe once every two or three races, sort of thing.
Yeah.
But that was enough for us. You know, we're doing a job for him. You know, we don't want to be his best mate.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know if I was there, I'd be best mate.
No, but that's the trouble all the Italians did. And that's something where you got to keep. There's got to be some separation when you're at that level.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You can't be his best mate.
Mm.
I mean, it's different. He's got Ucho and stuff like that. But everybody wanted to be his best mate. And you've got to separate your job from that. You know, you can have a good relationship with him, but everybody wanted to talk to him. Everybody wanted to suggest stuff and stuff like that. And that was moving on a little bit. Or we can go back to where we were. But that's kind of what happened when we went to Ducati.
Yeah.
Everybody wanted to have a piece of him.
Oh, of course.
And everybody wanted to talk to him about stuff, and it got to the point where it wasn't structured enough, you know, and he started to know too much about the bike, because you want a rider that understands the bike but doesn't know it technically enough to know everything about it. You know, I mean, everybody has a different approach to it.
Yeah.
You know, you have some crew chiefs that all make changes to a bike and just say, look, hey, we've done something to help you with the turning or to give you more grip. But don't break it down to tell you, okay, we've put a softer spring in it with some more preload and we've done the ride height, blah, blah, blah. The riders don't need to know that.
Mm.
They're there to just jump on the bike and ride the bike. They don't need to know all the technical side of it.
Yeah.
And that's what happened basically when we went to Ducati. Everybody wanted to tell him everything. And then it got to the point where he got so poisoned with what's going on and he knowing it all, then he became involved in the whole circle of trying to set the bike up.
Right.
Hopefully I'm not talking out of school, but that's pretty much how I see it from a mechanical point of view, because I was there and I could see what was fundamentally happening. And he never had that when he was with Yamaha, with JB, because JB would understand what's going on, look at the data, listen to all the comments, and go away and make the changes. And then you go and ride that. Hopefully this will help what you're struggling with. And wasn't poisoned with all the technical side.
That makes sense, though. That does make sense on what you're saying.
Well, 100%. I mean, riders think they want to know, but they don't need to know.
Mm.
You just go out there and concentrate on what you're doing. Let us concentrate on what we're doing.
Yeah, everyone's got a job.
Exactly. Our job is to make sure the wheels don't fall off. That guy's just make decisions on how we're going to make it go faster.
Mm.
That guy's going to do the electronics. You just get on and open up the throttle. So it sounds structured, but it needs to be structured.
Yeah. Of course. Like anything, I guess, really, isn't it?
Yeah, totally.
Absolutely.
And like for Daniel and I, just watching it on TV, everyone kind of looks like they're having fun and it's just a big party lifestyle almost to a degree, but it really is so structured. And as you said, you've never watched really Moto 3 or 125s or 250s because you've got a job to do.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, pretty much that's exactly what it is. If you're not working, you're out having some lunch and get back to the garage and make sure you've got everything, all your everything crossed, you know, make sure it's right for the session. So
that's a good point. So Rossi wins the title in 04, 05, amazing years obviously for you guys. Coming into 2006 on the, let's just say, one of the most beautiful looking bikes, the Camel Yamaha, that yellow. Hopefully you've still got some merch lying around of that one back in your closet, because that would be worth, I reckon, a lot. But with that bike, I've read a few things over the years that 2006, they had a 05, they had a perfect bike, and 2006 they tried to improve on perfection. Is that something how you see it, or how do you make of that?
I'm trying to recall it all, but I mean, I've still got some of the merch. I've got some team stuff at home.
Oh mate, we're coming over to have a look.
Raiden.
You're right about 2004, 2005, and the Camel bike. I remember well. I remember the bike blowing up in Le Mans when he was leading. Yeah, we had engine problems that year. I can't even remember. We there was definitely some issues with the chassis. I'm not sure whether it was that year, the same year as that, but yeah, that cost us a lot. That you can't afford to DNF races because of engine problems and stuff like that. So. But it's like all any motorsport, you're always trying to develop stuff to get better and you don't always get it right. And even of late, you know, the trouble is with the rules, when I say trouble with the rules are that once you start building something, you've got to keep that.
Mm.
Okay.
So there's no, if you have a problem with, you have a batch of pistons that crack or valves that pull the heads off, you know, once you're locked into something, you're kind of locked into that because you had set amount of engines that were pre-built and all that sort of stuff. So if you have problems...
You've got problems all the time.
You've got big problems, and I don't really agree that we weren't able to fix the problem to try and enhance the rider championship.
Yes.
The manufacturer's championship had a big bearing on the rider's championship.
Of course.
You know, because of that.
Yeah.
You know, you get something wrong, you know, and then it stuffs the whole system really for the championship. But I mean, they were the rules. But you know, we did have a couple of tough years where they made a chassis that wasn't that great either. And one, I can't even remember the year. We had three races before they finally decided to go back to the previous chassis. But
yeah, okay,
maybe 06. It's a bit of a rough start, wasn't it? 06.
I think so.
Yeah, I just can't remember.
I think he came back pretty hard, Valentino, the second half of the season, 06.
I just can't remember whether the engine and the chassis were the same year.
Yeah.
Feels like they weren't.
Yeah. We'll have to deep dive into that one.
Yeah.
Was Valencia 06, obviously not a great time for you guys, but was Valencia 06, we're all about conspiracies on this on this podcast as well. Was there a tie conspiracy? What was the feeling like before? This is Daniel and I were talking about this. What was the feeling like before and after that race? If you remember.
No, I remember him crashing. He only had to get a certain amount of points and he crashed on, I remember, the corner. I don't know. When you go into a situation like that where it's come down to the last race and you've got points, you just think, why are we in this situation? Mm. You know, what have you? Because you're throwing it all into one race and you just go, well, we fundamentally made mistakes during those other 16 races, because here we are now, and we must have had some DNFs for whatever reason, whether he crashed or we had engine failures or whatever. So you, even though he crashed in the race and you only need to get some points, you can't all hinge it just on that, because that's just a moment in time of the big picture.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it was hard to be – sure, we were disappointed, you know, just hoping that he gets back on and gets going again. You go, God, how did you crash doing that? You weren't even leading.
Mm.
You know, but you can't blame just that moment.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't believe there's a tie conspiracy or anything like that. I mean, we should have been further ahead in the championship. We had 16, 17 races and we only had like a 15-point lead or whatever we had, you know. Yeah. It wasn't enough. So, I mean, in hindsight, I think, well, of all the people to win the championship, it was fitting that Nicky won it.
Yeah, definitely.
Even though he wasn't dominant, you know. So, yeah, it was, I don't know. We'd already won titles, but at that point, I didn't feel like we were dominant that year like we were the year before. You know, I just felt like we couldn't do any wrong then, and then the following years where we were really dominant. But that year was a tough year anyway. Mm. You know, we had engine blows, you know, blowing up and stuff like that. It wasn't like we were just plain sailing.
Yeah.
So I won't say it was kind of fitting that we didn't win it. We would have loved to win it. Yeah. But you know, end of the day, it was come down to the last race. You don't ever want to win or lose a championship by that. We should have been better earlier. Yep.
Better
for whatever reasons, you know. So, yeah, I mean, one thing about racing, you have good and bad days, and you just got to put one thing you got to do is better put
the bad ones
put
away,
put it aside, and rock on. Otherwise, it eats you up.
Yep, makes sense. I guess that's why the best riders are the best riders. I'm sure they just move on from it. And
yeah, you got to learn something from it. I mean, there's always a reason that, you know, like, okay, engine blow up, okay, what happened? They got to understand why and fix it. Or, you know, if the rider crashed, was it a mistake by the rider? I mean, riders are only human. They make silly mistakes.
Yeah,
I mean,
of course.
I've seen Valentino ride crashed on an out lap. You know, you just go, what the hell?
Yeah.
You know, as good as he is,
he
was still human.
That's it. I think people are quick to forget that aspect of riders in general.
Yeah, I mean, they're all the same. No matter whether you're a world champion or a national champion, you know.
Yeah.
Everyone goes out there and sometimes you think you're better than you are or the bike's better than it is.
Yeah. Ambition outweighs the talent.
That's another story, isn't it? I don't think you guys got enough time for all that.
We've got all the time in the world. Yeah, so yeah. If you want to elaborate on that, by all means.
Yeah, we'll order some pizzas, no worries.
No, I don't think you... The only thing I can elaborate on that is just that you saw what everybody else saw.
Yeah.
You know, him go down there. I don't know why he went down with his helmet on, but...
Probably a smart move.
Yeah, no. I don't think he thought there was going to be any conflict, but he, you know, he was doing the right thing going down there.
Yeah.
Casey didn't appreciate it.
Tough years at Ducati. How did you guys combat that? What was the feeling like in the team? You touched on it before. Valentino got too in-depth with everything.
Yeah, I don't think the in-depth part of it was not the biggest problem. Yep. I mean, and to be honest, when we went there, after when Valentino came to Yamaha, because I mean, I was already there and we thought everyone was doing half a reasonable job, thought the Honda was better. And then he managed to win on the Yamaha, went, well, shoot. And then when he started talking about going to Ducati, I mean, no one was jumping up and down going, yeah, let's go.
Yeah, of course.
But he wanted us to go with him, so we all went with him. But in the back of my mind, I thought, you know what? We got to better fix that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've got JB's a smart guy, and there's other people around him that got some good ideas and stuff like that. Maybe we can make this thing work.
Yeah, you've done it before. Why not do it again?
Yeah, exactly. And Valentino's the type of guy he is. He's always loves a challenge. You only know that because he's racing cars now, blah, 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 that sort of stuff. But, I mean, and kudos to him for wanting to try it, even though it didn't work out. But, again, for all the – I mean, the bike was – I mean, when he jumped on it, Casey had stopped winning on that bike.
Yes. You know,
like, I mean, it wasn't – that wasn't the bike that he won the title on.
Yeah. That was completely different.
Completely different. Out of carbon, monocoque.
Yes.
Part of the chassis and all that sort of stuff. And it took a long time. Everybody that was riding that thing was crashing it. It wasn't just Valentino.
We had two world champions on it. You had Nicky and Valentino.
Yeah, and Dovi was on it as well. Yeah. And it took them a few years to work it out. But, again, there was – I honestly thought when we went there, I went, cool, an Italian team. I bet you that, you know, we'll have a session. They'll sit around or even after the weekend, sit around and go, okay, how are we going to fix this? Because being a smaller company, someone that more hands-on, I thought – these guys are going to make this thing work in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
You know, if they listen to what JB says or Valentino says, they'll make changes. It's a little bit different from like a Japanese big corporate monster where it takes a lot longer to make stuff happen. To get
through those lines, yeah.
But it never really happened. The changes never really happened, the ones that we wanted. You know, there was key people involved in Ducati that, I say, had their own agenda.
Yeah. That's
pretty much the best way I could put it. And it just didn't flow like it should have, like I thought it was going to flow, like from my point of view, you know. And I'm sure Valentino was disappointed that we never got the changes to try and make the thing better. I mean, you look at it now, the bike's not like it was then.
No.
That was an era when they went from the steel chassis to an aluminium one, and we were in that era when they had that carbon
thing,
one. It was just so stiff. You know, there was just no feel to it, and the guys were crashing on the front. They didn't even know they were going to crash. So, for all his effort and his ideas of wanting to go there, I mean, I know he wanted to pull the pin. You know,
early.
He had a 2-year contract, but he had to stick it out. So, it was a shame that it didn't work. I mean, it was challenging for sure. I don't regret growing there because it was just another thing we did with him, and it was a learning curve. And you know, it was nice to work on the Ducati, as tricky as it was definitely not the easiest bike to work on.
I was going to say, if it's anything like the road bikes, it would have been a bit of a pain.
Oh, yeah.
There would have been so many different, like, stupid sizing on parts and...
Yeah. I mean, you work on the Yamaha, you take, like, I don't know.
Just get the 10 mil out.
Five spanners and you can do pretty much everything. That you had to have 25. It was just incredible.
It's crazy.
Something to change something on the brake, you had to have just a tray full of stuff. And it was But they never really improved on that. Like, even though we were trying to say, look, hey, don't use a 23mm hex head bolt. Use 22 and 24 like everybody else. We had them there. We had plenty of them there, but it just makes it hard.
Yeah, they don't want to waste stuff, the Italians.
There were so many. Yeah, I know, right? There were so many little things that could have been better. And they improved in time.
Of course.
Like, because they had to. You know, it was just...
That's right.
Everything was too difficult to do.
Yeah. I think the change in management might have helped that as well.
Oh, 100%. And we look where they are now.
Yeah. Yeah.
They needed someone new to drive it.
Yeah.
And it was a bit like when Valley came to Yamaha. They had new people and the team leader was just like so focused and motivated.
Yeah.
And that's what got Ducati where they are now for sure. I mean, you've got to have good technicians around you, but
definitely
you've got to have someone there that's got the drive to make it work and listen to all the right people.
Yeah, for sure. Because like you said, mentioned before, I'm sure so many lines can be blurred, and especially as you mentioned, they're trying to be friends with him.
Yeah, sure.
Like, they're probably pissing in his pocket saying, no, you know, whereas your guy's like, no, this is how it is.
No, exactly, because, I mean, we wanted to get the job done and win races sort of thing, but those guys, they've just spent hours talking to him, and they just ask a lot of questions that didn't need to be asked. Yeah. You know, like, I mean, I just think back to how the simple times were. Rider would come in, sit down, and the crew chief, which was JB, he'd just sit down there and listen, have his notepad out. Then Valentino would talk about everything about the bike.
Yeah.
He goes, is that it? Cool. That was it. He'd walk away.
Yep.
He'd go to his computer, go and talk to the suspension technician, and then they may come up with a plan. Valentino would go away, go and have lunch, go and have a massage, whatever you want to do. But in the other manufacturer, he'd sit down there and they're going, So what do you think about that? And what about this here? And we're going to do this. And just got so poisoned. Mm. It was just like, you could see it unfolding. We're just going, oh my God. It's like when the rider comes in, you go, how are the brakes? We didn't mention the brakes. Why are you going to ask him about the brakes? Because now he's thinking about his brakes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, if you want to look at it in layman's terms, that was how it is.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't ask him about something that's not wrong. If there's something wrong, he's going to tell you.
Yeah.
And normally the first thing that comes out of rider's mouth is the biggest problem.
Mm. Yeah.
So you've got to eliminate all the bullshit around the edges and focus on the stuff that's important. Because asking him that, he just goes, oh, it's overload for the rider. Mm. You know, he just wants to open up the throttle and pull on the brake.
That's right.
You tell him too much, and then he gets to the point where he goes, oh, last time we did put that spring in, didn't feel very good, or the bike didn't turn. You're going, dude, you only know half the story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we stuffed up. Maybe we did something wrong at that time or some of that. Honesty is the key. I mean, you've got to be, okay, he doesn't need to know too much, but if something goes wrong, and everybody's been involved in this that's been in racing, if something goes wrong or someone makes a mistake, you've got to fess up. Whether it was something that a mechanic did or a setting change that didn't work, because the rider then thinks that what we did doesn't work.
And scraps the whole thing.
And in his mind, he's going, we can't do that because of that. But hang on a minute, mate. That wasn't what caused the problem.
Yeah, it was.
So you've got to be super honest and clear with the rider.
Yeah.
If you want the best result from it, that's how you got to be. And a lot of times it wasn't. In the later days, it wasn't like that, and it needed to be.
Yeah.
Guys needed to be up front and tell them exactly how it was, cut through the bullshit.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing.
And be honest. Don't butter it up, or, you know, just say it how it is.
Yeah, that's right.
We're all big here, you know. Ooh. And
100%. And I'm sure someone like that would much more be appreciative of that delivery.
Well, that's it. I mean, that's how it was from us from the Southern Hemisphere, because we weren't trying to piss in his pocket.
Yeah, that's right.
We've been winning races. Mm. We just wanted more of it.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes to our demise, I think that's a fair comment, looking back, you know, that's how it was, but not everybody sees it that way.
Yeah.
God, it's so fascinating. You see riders like Aleix Espargaró come into the pits and they're real hot, like heavy, you know, yelling, screaming, whacking stuff.
Animated.
It seemed like from the outside anyway, Valentino was quite calm no matter what. Is that better? I'm sure that seems to work better for the whole team environment if you're just a rider. Like if a rider's coming in really animated, does it kind of make everyone walk on eggshells, you reckon?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, the rider has to be calm for sure.
Yeah.
Because what you want in the garage, I mean, we talk about that a lot as mechanics. I mean, when the rider comes in, no matter what's going on, you've got to put that persona on there that everything's under control. Don't look flustered. Don't look worried. Don't look fucking like you're in a hurry.
Yeah.
Even though sometimes you are. You want him to sit down there and get ready to put his helmet on, knowing that everything's under control. And so the last thing you want is to see the rider come in and throwing shit around. I mean, Valentino, maybe he went back to his motorhome and did that stuff.
Yeah.
But he never did it in the garage.
Yeah.
Carlos did heaps of times.
Maybe it's a Spanish thing.
I was going to say.
But I don't know.
Oh, I'm sure Max would have done it a few times.
Yeah,
as well.
True.
Yeah, but Valentino never did. No, he was, I mean, if he was really pissed off with something or disappointed with himself or whatever, he just wouldn't come back to the garage. He'd go to the motorhome first and come back later, which is the right thing. Yeah, vent your steam off in your motorhome with all your mates and then come back and talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is far more professional, because someone always sees something.
Yeah.
Somebody always hears something.
And yeah.
The last thing you want is a professional rider throwing his toys out of the pram, you know?
Mm.
Especially for him, with the cameras on him 24/7.
Yeah.
Oh, he just doesn't get a break.
Yeah, it makes the most sense. Straight in there, privacy.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, it didn't happen that often, but, you know, we had no qualms with it if he disappeared and come back half an hour later.
That must be exhausting for him, though, and being at just a race weekend, like in Australia. You know, he was just, everyone was all over him, and I couldn't imagine Italy or somewhere in Europe. Like, it just must be so full on.
Yeah, when I think about Australia, I think that's probably his easy one for sure for him. Japan's crazy.
They love it, don't they?
Yeah. They're just so fanatical. But in Europe, I mean, you just have security guys everywhere, and he got to the stage where in the peak of it, you had steel barriers down the side of the truck so nobody could get in because you couldn't even get to the truck to get parts. It was pretty full on. That's full on. It's mega superstar stuff for sure.
Yeah, I remember Tom, our other guy who's not here, other co-host, we've been going to the Grand Prix just like Daniel forever. And like we'd always see, like you knew Valentino was somewhere because you'd kind of hear a scooter and then just like a crowd of people chasing the scooter. And it's just, you're just thinking how, like, I wouldn't even know how to deal with that situation.
Yeah, he did very well to deal with it because he's a very personal person. Yeah. You know, like, I mean, he likes his own space. You know, and you only have to look at how he is. He's got a core group around him. And even now, like, you never see him on social media. Mm. I mean, he's on media now because of his car racing, but
he's
not one of these guys that he's not flashy.
Yeah.
I mean, he looks like he's a street kid, honestly.
Yeah.
With what he wears, drives a nice car, but, you know.
You wouldn't look twice if you walked past or something.
You wouldn't even, unless you knew him, you'd never know.
Yeah.
And to be able to put up with all that, he did really well considering I couldn't have coped with it.
Yeah. I don't think many people could, or break a lot of people and then, you know, they'll retire from the sport early, whatever it would be.
We've seen before.
Yeah.
Well, Casey's a prime example of that.
Yeah.
Yep. Exactly. Great call. Right. I was going to ask about 2015, the whole, because we've got a big Marquez supporter over here and the whole kicking incident. I think.
Don't you guys need to take a break now?
From my point of view, I think that whole thing was handled poorly by everyone.
Yeah,
in MotoGP.
100%.
And I think it ruined a great championship.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that as a one-eyed Rossi supporter. And I think a lot of people will agree that it just ruined that last race.
Oh, totally. It should never got to that point. It's interesting how it manifested from Phillip Island. That's where it started.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just with the battle that Marquez and was having with everybody and, for whatever reason, Valentino felt like he was holding everybody up and then jetted off and did that. And there was heated words with everybody. And I don't believe he kicked him. I honestly don't believe. But, I mean, it was a shame that the whole race went that way because just what you said, I mean, it destroyed the championship, you know. I mean, because Marquez wasn't even in the championship.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to the Valentino's guys, his close guys, I said, guys, you got to calm Valentino down. Marquez is not even in the championship. He's fucking with us on this one. Sorry about that.
No.
Yeah, go for it.
But, you know, don't let this get out of hand because the only person it's going to affect is us.
Yeah.
It's not going to affect Marquez because Lorenzo's in the championship, blah, blah, blah. And who else? I can't remember who else we're battling with. Was it Lorenzo?
I think it was just Lorenzo,
yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, the only winner out of this is going to be Lorenzo.
Mm.
Not us, you know, because if it gets really emotional, and I couldn't believe what was going on the track. I was going, oh, wow, there's no way that's going to end right. And to get that penalty, I think that was uncalled for, the penalty, especially when it wasn't clear cut. That's what happened.
That's right.
You know, to put him at the back of the grid, especially when it was the championship. I mean, give him some sort of penalty, but not that. I mean,
that's right.
How are we going to win the championship from last?
Mm.
But he had a fair buddy crack.
It's so interesting that they always talk about the Spanish mafia, whatever it is, but it's just such a big call and such a big rider to do that.
But it showed that day. They didn't even try and pass Lorenzo.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It was,
I'm not going to ramble on, otherwise I'm going to start losing my mind.
No, it was that whole thing was very, very disappointing at the end of that season because, you know, we should have won that championship. We should have won two other championships, I feel, you know, that we missed out on for various reasons, but that was 100% one that was in the public eye that we should have won.
Yeah. Speaking of Lorenzo, we call him Cheeseburger Lorenzo because he's put on a bit of weight these days.
Haven't they all?
They have. 2008, 2009, they put up the famous wall in the garage. What was that like for yourself?
Funny, I was just sitting in the garage today, and because the garage is here, they've got a concrete wall between them, and one of the other mechanics was on the other side. I said, "Jesus, this feels like Lorenzo Valentino. They've put a wall up for us." Just laughing about it. It's funny you say that.
Yeah, Halliday versus Jones.
Yeah, it's crew Halliday up to something that we don't know.
No, not at all. That whole thing was blown out of proportion, to be honest.
Okay.
Really, you know, I can't even remember. To be honest, I can't remember the reason it started. I think it was because of the tire manufacturer. Tire
wars.
Yeah, it had changed a little bit.
Oh, Bridgestone and Michelin, wasn't it? Yeah.
There was a crossover period, and it sort of started from that, and then the media got a hold of it. And all of a sudden it was because we didn't want to share data and all this sort of stuff, but it wasn't anything like that. I mean, us as mechanics, we just thought it was a bunch of bullshit.
Okay.
Because all the mechanics get on. It was only the riders, and it was only the public PR stuff that played on it. So that was really nothing. Of all the things that happened in the career, that didn't even
isn't that funny?
Didn't even rank with me. But I mean, everybody got hold of it and ran with it.
Yeah. Oh, as fans, like, I was laughing it up. I thought it was fantastic.
Oh, yeah. It makes a good story, most things, you know. You can make a good story out of everything, can you?
Oh, yeah, that's all right. And, like, you know, I like Cheeseburger Lorenzo now. We call it the Jorge Lorenzo effect. It's like, I hated Jorge Lorenzo back in the day. Like, it was Valentino till I die. You know, he's the man. And like, you got this young Spanish kid, like, kind of copying him as well, the celebrations. Rossi had the sun and the moon. Lorenzo had the devil and the angel. And, you know, like, just seeing him win. I used to get so angry seeing him win. So it was just so interesting seeing those two go at it. Did you feel tension between them at all? Or did you have even much to do with Jorge?
No, I didn't really have anything to do with him, but being a teammate, you always bump into him down and out of the garage, and he was always really polite.
Yeah.
Same with Max. I mean, it was not like there's a hate against the mechanics. Yeah, and
that's true.
And Max was a little bit smarter because he'd stop and talk to you because he wanted to try and get
something
out.
He wanted something out of you.
That's a good play.
Whereas Lorenzo wasn't that smart to do that. You know,
he'd want to be talking about himself, I reckon, not someone else's data.
But yeah, the trouble with Jorge was a super talent. You know, and tough. My God, that guy was tough. Mm. The only person I would compare him to was Carlos. Carlos would crash, hurt himself up,
rebound,
jump back on. Well, you look at Lorenzo when he crashed in Assen.
Yeah, yeah.
Went that was a superhuman effort.
Went down to Spain.
One of the best rides ever.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's how tough that guy is. He really is. And but no, we never felt the tension from that. And again, there was probably in that relationship between Valentino and Jorge, that was pretty strong, you know, vibes between the two of them. Mm. It was like Max is gone. Okay, who's the next challenger? Is him or was Sete before that?
Yeah,
you know, he had
so he was punting him off in Jerez.
Yeah,
over Phillip Island as well, 2004.
Yeah, he turned in on him.
Yeah, well, that's what I'd be telling people too.
I remember he was dirty in the park for me. I remember that.
Clearly,
he didn't want to talk to any of us.
Yeah, it's and you know, you got two big racing egos going at it, fighting for the same line in, you know, Seto's backyard in Jerez.
Yeah,
that's an iconic corner. That a lot's happened
I know, and for the future. But talking about Lorenzo, Valentino, I say everything sort of came natural to him, like as far as like getting the fans, and he was welcoming. Everybody wanted to be part of Valentino, whereas Jorge really tried really hard to be something and kind of never was, as far as like in the public.
Yeah.
He had his core fans for sure, don't get me wrong. He had fucking people that loved him.
Yeah.
But it didn't come as easy as it did for Valentino.
Yeah.
And when I say come easy for Valentino, he worked it, but he worked it in a nice way.
That's right.
You know.
100%. And you can still see it to this day, the yellow flags flying around.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's incredible, isn't it?
It's amazing. Yeah, it is. It is interesting with Lorenzo Cheeseburger. It is true. It does seem a bit forced, I guess, watching it as a fan. And you know, the thing is you as a fan in any sport or anything, you know, you love to hate someone as well. You need to see that rivalry, whether it be Max and Valentino or Sete or Marc Marquez and Rossi or whoever it is. You know, that's the thing that gravitates a lot of people.
I think that's what the sport's missing now, to be honest.
I was just going to ask you.
100%.
I mean, back then, I think about that era when I was involved in it, you got Max, and I mean, that was massive rivalry.
And two Italians as well.
On track to go up the stairs and having the punch up, and then Sete, and then Lorenzo, a little bit to the fake Casey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but back then, Valentino was the master of manipulation. He just fucked with people.
Yeah, big time.
You know, and you don't have that now. You've got, since Valentino's gone, okay, even in the last years that he was there, he didn't have the star power or wasn't as dominant as he was. So, but you've got nobody. I mean, these guys now,
they're too friendly.
You have correct. You have the two first and second and third on the podium. They'll probably out having dinner at night the night before. You just go, what the?
Yeah, it makes no sense.
I mean, you got to hate the guy.
Yeah.
I mean, really, if you want to beat him that badly,
yeah.
I don't know. It's like the whole world, mate. It's gone soft.
Yeah, it's gone soft. Soft as butter, I reckon.
Yeah. That's a fair. That's what we get frustrated with. Yeah. Like, especially take Lamont last year, Pecco and Maverick. They're punching on in the gravel trap, smacking each other in the helmet, and then they're riding on the same scooter back, cuddling each other, saying, "It's all good, buddy."
Yeah, I know. What's up with that?
Like
two-minute flash anger.
Like, it makes no sense.
It doesn't.
Look at Doohan and Crivier going back to Jerez. Like,
yeah,
exactly.
The Spanish wanted to storm the podium, and he's lapping it up, going, "Yep, thanks, guys."
Well, these guys haven't got any charisma as far as like manipulating the riders. You know, I mean, the most you'll get is Jorge Martin talk about he's getting pissed off with Ducati because he's going to leave because they're
going to
get a factory bike. But there's no hate towards anybody. I mean,
there's no mind games.
You don't have to physically hate the guy, but
play it out.
Put it out there.
Yeah. Mm.
Give yourself a bit of an edge. Like, screw with the guy.
Yeah.
And you'll gain so many followers from it as well, you know.
I think that's what everybody wants. I mean,
everyone wants it.
I love watching the racing now because it's, I don't know, I always wonder what it was going to be like when Valentino left, you know, when he's at his peak. But it was always going to be, there's always going to be riders, you know.
And
to be honest, there hasn't been the dominance that Valentino had. Even now with all these great guys, there's no one out there going out there winning 10 races in a season.
Yeah.
No.
I mean, at the moment, you could, and Jerez coming up, I don't know, who would you pick to win it? Jorge could, Bagnaia, Aleix, Maverick. I mean, there's a bootload of guys that could win it. No one you'd say, okay, these guys are going to have a battle.
Well, I don't think anyone last year won two main races on the trot.
It's incredible. I mean,
that's crazy.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. I think these guys need to – I think sometimes they could use that emotion to better power.
Mm.
I mean, a lot of people go, no one has to be angry. Okay, well, I'm not saying angry.
Mm.
But use that emotion.
Yeah,
if you want to have an edge, everybody's fit. Everybody's got great bikes. Everybody can do that. Use another tool that's there to get ahead. And Valentino did.
Yeah, he used the media for his gain, really.
Totally. He just got in everybody's head.
Yeah.
They were defeated before they even lined up on the grid.
Yeah.
100%. I remember him saying when he had a battle with Zeta, he goes, "You'll never win another race, mate." I'm telling you.
Remember that. Yeah, he put the curse on him.
And he never did. I mean, what's that? I mean,
that's confidence in your ability, but isn't it ever?
I mean, and he would have put it to the wall to make sure that never happened. You know, so if that takes you to do that,
do it.
Good for you.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I'm sure there's sports people out there that do it that are like that.
100%.
I don't know. Everyone's got soft. I mean, the guys aren't. They're tough guys. Don't get me wrong. But I mean, emotionally, they're all soft.
Yeah, yeah. Play on that.
I saw a rugby league player the other day cry because someone called him something. I would go, "Serious, dude?"
Yeah.
So we were at the footy last night, and I was calling I called the umpire maggot about 1,000 times. I reckon that's why I got my voice is a bit croaky. He deserves it, but
exactly. Yeah, you run with that.
With you finishing up in the GP paddock, you didn't get to finish with Valentino, is that correct? Unfortunately.
Yeah, no, he didn't because he went to
Patronus,
yeah. And the other guy I work with, Alex Briggs, he lives here. I actually went to them because I wanted to try and finish the story
with him. Would have been beautiful.
And so I went and saw the guys and tried to get a job there, but because Patronus had a Moto2 team and stuff like that, and they were trying to bring all their guys up. And I tried hard because I was happy to do it for not much money. It was never going to be about the money.
It was just about the.
I just wanted to finish that, and they kind of understood it. But and all the journalists like Matt Burke and all those guys, they go, no, you'll be right, you'll be there. And they just could not believe nobody could believe that we never got to finish the story.
Yeah, isn't that incredible?
It's crazy.
Yeah,
and it was probably the most disappointing part of the whole journey for me.
Yeah,
because. You know, he wasn't winning. He wasn't doing all the stuff, but I just so wanted to be there that last race when everybody celebrated and it was an end of an era, because it was an end of an era. Yeah. I feel like we got sort of robbed that one year.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I got no hard feelings for it, but I just wish it was different.
You've been there for so long. Like, what's a year, seriously?
Over 400 races and 50-odd race wins.
Championships.
Yeah. And the other guys too. Bernie and Alex, they were there with Honda with him as well, so even longer.
Yeah. There you go.
Anyway, it is what it is, mate. You can't change it.
Yeah.
That's it. How do you see the sport these days without post Valentino, which is a weird world in MotoGP.
The strangest.
It is, but it's like everything gradually changes, yeah, you know.
It does.
And you just, before you know it, you kind of forget, you know, although a lot of us don't.
Yeah.
But I see the racing, and I think it's great, to be honest. I think the sprint racing was a really good thing. I mean, it's a bit more excitement. I mean, and I think everybody that's involved in the teams and that have accepted it and realised that it's good for marketing and everything like that. And like we said before, the fact that I bet you nobody can pick the winner
that is a good thing.
When we go to Spain next weekend, and the championship's still well alive, even though it doesn't seem to take much for someone to get a bit of a jump.
Mm.
But I think it's going great, to be honest.
Mm.
I still really love watching it.
Yeah, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
Would you ever jump back in? Have you had the opportunity to potentially go and work with, say, Luca Marini or in Rossi's team, having that connection?
Yeah, the year that I didn't have a chance to go to Petronas, Ucho and that, they organised a job for me with Luca.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. Yep. But the conditions were really bad.
Okay.
I wasn't prepared to do that to hopefully get a job the following year. And I turned it down. And then the following year, they offered me a job with Bezzecchi, with Marco.
Yeah.
Okay.
With a VR team. And that was when we just got hit with COVID. And the year before that, me and the other guy got stuck over there for 6 months because, you remember, at the beginning of COVID, they put all the races off.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then come June, they said, okay, we're going to have a full season. So we went over there, and pretty much the week we got there, they said, you guys haven't got a job next year, but you're stuck here for 6 months. Just to do the full season. So it was a bit of a kick out of the butt.
Yeah.
And
it's unfortunate.
Yeah, and that was when I got a chance with Luca. But then I got off the job with Seki with the VR46 team, and it was the beginning of their team. But they wanted me to go over there in November, basically to go over there to the workshop and build everything. And at that stage, we were still in full lockdown with COVID.
Yeah.
And I was prepared to go when I wanted to go, but I just kept putting it off because I was a little bit nervous that if I jumped on the plane in November, I wouldn't get back maybe to April.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd just done 6 months stint over there.
Yeah.
You know? So I put it off, and in the end they had to get somebody else. So I sort of lost my opportunity there. But in hindsight, I think, you know, what point do you go back, and what point do you, I mean, is 25 years traveling around the world enough?
Yeah.
Yeah, what am I looking at again? I mean, Bezzecchi had a great season and he's a great rider and the team's perfect. I know a lot of the guys in there, blah, blah, blah. It would have been great. I just go, at some point, you just got to stop.
Does the travelling just take its toll after years?
It's funny because I've been travelling long enough that when I first started, we didn't have all the security like we did, you know, like at the airports. It was just so much easier.
Yeah.
But we were lucky that we had really good contracts with Yamaha, and 90% of my flights and stuff were business class.
Oh, that's all right. Nice.
So flying backwards and forwards was not the – I mean, I'd jump on a plane and have a meal, watch a movie and fall asleep, and before you knew it, you're in, I don't know, Bologna or somewhere, you know. So that part of it wasn't – the airports and that wear you out, but you just got into a methodical rhythm of it. You just get on the plane and do this and do that. But there's no way I could do what I did if I ever had a fly economy like that. Because seriously, we did – the last year that me and Alex did it, we did 450 hours flying.
Yeah.
Not airport time, just an aeroplane. So there's no way you could do that in economy.
No way.
You'd have to stay in Europe for, you know, months on end. So
yeah.
Anyway, so it was good. It was, I think the whole thing sort of forced our hand a little bit.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's days I watch the racing and go, you know, because I look at it through a different set of eyes. You know, everyone watches the racing and I'm watching the mechanics doing that, and I'm looking at my watch and going, okay, these guys are doing this now. They're preparing this, or it's this time of the day, and they're just getting ready to warm the bikes up, blah, 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 all that sort of stuff. So I see it a bit different, and I miss that. I miss the camaraderie with all the mechanics and all that, and the excitement. I mean, the Yamaha guys aren't having much excitement at the moment, but you know, we've all been through that. It's not all beer and Skittles all the time. You've got to put up with those hard yards because it'll change around,
yeah,
but it'll just take time. So you know, it's okay to say it's good money and blah, 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 but you've got to still be passionate about what you're doing and enjoy it.
Yeah.
Which is, and even the tough times when we're at Ducati, you know, every day we'd go to the racetrack, I think, okay, today's the day we're going to find out what's going on with this bike and we're going to make some improvements and have a good race.
Yeah.
Everyone's got their mindset.
Yeah. Mm. You got to love it, don't you? And to be doing those traveling hours.
Oh, man.
You know, like we complain about waking up at 4 a.m. just to catch a flight or whatever it is, but doing that all the time, like it would take its toll, really would.
Yeah, we didn't spend that much time in Europe because it'd been pretty much we'd have a race and we'd jump on a plane Monday morning and fly home and be home Tuesday night.
Yeah.
So and then I'd jump a plane on again on Monday morning and go back.
Mm.
So it was, I mean, people talk about flying and fly out and mining. This was next level.
Yeah, Jesus.
FIFO. There you go. You would have travelled to obviously a ton of amazing places. One of your favourite tracks that you've travelled to and maybe countries for whatever reasons?
Mugello for sure.
Yep.
As far as like, you know, Tuscany's beautiful and because that was his, before we had Misano, that was his home Grand Prix. Yeah. And I mean, back in the prime days, that was like people walking to Mecca. I mean, I just can't explain how busy, how frantic, how off the wall that place was. You know, we would drive there and you'd be driving through and there'd be 4 kilometres of cars parked on the side of the road and people just you couldn't even drive, mate. There was just people everywhere. Everybody was in yellow. I mean, everybody. Yeah. You couldn't even see a Honda shirt.
Yeah.
You know, it was one of those things I always think back on and think how amazing it was. But that was probably one of the best tracks. I mean, I like Donington because it was a beautiful track and stuff like that. But, 100% Mugello was the one for me.
I remember the commentators talking about Mugello and, like, you know, they'd be at the track or whatever, wake up at the track and it's 5, 6 a.m. and they could still hear everyone partying on the hills. And you see those, like, you know, big chainsaw motors and they're just, like, going off. It's nuts. All night, just massive megaphone exhaust pipes.
It was crazy because it's in a valley, you know, and there's just like people camping and everything. And it's exactly that back in the last few years, it wasn't like that because it became really expensive. But just the valley was filled with smoke and all you could hear was these chainsaws just blaring and it was madness, absolute madness.
The Italians know how to do it right though and they know how to make a motorsport Grand Prix, right? I think.
Yeah. Oh, they're so passionate. My God, they were so passionate with the valley. No. I mean, when they in the garages after the races, when we because they got the big glass plastic panels sort of thing in the garage doors, we had to have security. They just push the windows in. I mean, you close the door down, you got the people got their arms under there. They just you couldn't close it. It was incredible. Yeah,
that's bonkers.
Fun times.
That's absolutely insane. Did you ever score some cool merch off the great man? Do you ever give you a suit or a helmet or some little bits of paraphernalia or
it's funny that that's a weird thing about the whole deal. All his knee sliders, Ucho used to always get them. You know, his best mate, and he'd get them signed and make a few bucks on the side. That was in his early days.
His
like
best
that.
Mates making money off him.
Yeah, yeah, but that was all
cool. I'd be doing that Italians, if you were doing that though,
because Valentino was okay with that.
Yeah,
and I thought, you know, when we finish, sure. I mean, after all this time, get a ride a suit or something, but Valley was it'd give us, you know, we had all those special helmets, you know,
that's like cool
with our hands, our face, all that stuff. He'd get all those, you know, made him give us those, and he was generous in that way. But I never got a ride a suit or one of his original helmets, even though he's got 10,000 of the things. But I never did. One of the guys that left, you know, way before us, he got a race suit, and I just go,
shit.
I thought for sure we were going to get one. Sure.
Oh, if you're listening, Valentino, got to get Brent a buddy race suit.
Brent wants one of his race suits, please, buddy. I'll see you in September.
Yeah. We'll clip it in and look, send us another two for number three for Daniel, Tom, and I as well. Or
exactly.
We'll meet you over at the ranch.
Exactly.
Yeah. Did you ever get the chance to go to the ranch?
Yeah, we went 3 times.
Yep. Did you ever get to ride it?
Yep.
What's it like?
Yeah. Well, cool. Valley was really good because when we go to Misano, he'd organise a on Wednesday night or Thursday night, he'd organise a night at the ranch where just for the mechanics.
Oh, that's unreal.
So we'd go there, and he had a bootload of bikes and stuff like that, and all the PR people, everybody would turn up there. So there was probably 12, 15 of us riding sort of thing, just grab a bike and we'd bring our gear out there. And it was good because he'd go out there and he'd, because the track's pretty tricky,
yep,
in a flat track if you're not used to doing it. And we'd all ride around and we'd, and then we'd have like lap timers on it, so we, you know, for qualifying. And then Valentino would go out and he'd ride around with us and try and show us some lines and stuff like that. And then we'd start racing and we'd have like three races and a final or a qualifying and then two races or three races. And he'd do all the commentary.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it'd be heaps of all of his mates and stuff. There'd probably be like 50 people there and he's doing all the commentary for us racing.
That's it was so really good.
So we did that on three different occasions.
That's cool. That's a great story.
Oh, it was fun. And then we'd finish that and then we'd because he's got a cool little old, really old sort of house there that's been made into like a big kitchen restaurant. And his mates would turn up there and they'd cook his feed and there'd be like 80 people upstairs all having dinner together. And then the videos going there of all the footage that they took that night of the racing.
What a setup.
Yeah, it was cool. That was really good. That was the cool times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the perks, I guess, you know. And I was going to say, like, that's... I was just thinking when you were talking about driving down into Mugello, like there would be fans on there that would sell their grandma just to be in your position.
Oh, totally. I mean, it was bizarre. The emotion that, you know, some of the people were, you know, people crying and stuff like that. I mean, it would get people into the garage, whether we brought them in or someone else brought them in, and they're just crying being in the garage. Just
isn't like amazing?
So emotional. Oh.
Besides
himself, you know, like,
yeah, but it's amazing that someone, just the psychological effect that someone has to do that to people. Not many sports people out there that can, not many people in general that can do that. And you know, for a kind of a larrikin, which he is, especially in the early days, like as I said, jumping in a toilet or,
you know, rocks and stuff.
Yeah, Naomi Campbell, the blow up doll on the 250s or whatever, 125s. Like,
yeah, it's pretty funny back then, wasn't it, in the early days.
And it's just that effect, you know, it's insane. A funny story, I was like 5 years old and we had the MotoGP game and all we wanted to do was unlock Valentino Rossi, and I was like a school night. It was like 1 a.m. My dad wakes me up. He goes, James, I've just unlocked Valentino Rossi. And he's like, I'm like, oh my God, that's amazing. He's like, all right, I go back to sleep now. I'm like, how am I supposed to go back to sleep?
Didn't even get to play it.
Nah.
That was painful.
That's dear.
But that's the effect, you know, that random guy in Italy has.
That's incredible. Yeah.
You still keep in touch with him?
Yeah, I sent him a message once a month sort of thing, just see how he's going. I caught up with him, not this year at Bathurst, but the year before. I went down there a few days down there and went out for dinner with him and had a look around the garage with him and stuff like that. So no, he's good. I mean, I don't contact with him all the time, but enough to do the right thing. And he's always nice, you know, messaging back. And I've just booked tickets to go to Europe in September. So
nice.
I'm going to go to Misano this year and take the family over there. Yeah.
That's really awesome. Cool.
Hmm. Should be good.
Absolutely. This weekend, what are the thoughts? What are the feelings?
I think it's going to be a tough race. I mean, we tested here pretty good, but so did a lot of other guys. Yeah. The championship's pretty good at the moment.
Tight,
like, yeah. I mean, when I watch the racing, you know, there's numerous cases. There's been five guys that could win the race. You know, and it's great to see, because if you go back 2 or 3 years, it wasn't like that.
Mm. Yeah,
it was like pretty much Maxwell
dominating.
Yeah, pretty much dominating. But we're in a reasonably good place, I'd say. It's not one of Crew's favourite tracks, but we're second in the championship, and you know,
Coming off a good result in Sydney.
Yeah, Josh is pretty solid though. You know, he's even on his bad days, he's good.
Yeah,
and with, you know, a few of those other guys racing that aren't here, that sort of gave him a little bit more of a buffer, because the people in between took some points away from us.
Yep.
But anyway, that's what it is. But yeah, we'll just chip away. I think if we have a good solid weekend here, try and get on the podium. And I mean, Crew's really good in Sydney. He's really good in Phillip Island. So Morgan Park's going to be tough for us.
Yeah.
Jonesy's really good there. So, and Josh. So we just got to up our game there, really.
Good event, the Sydney one.
Yeah.
I was up this year for it. And it was crazy. The night racing was awesome.
What's up with the weather there? The 2 years in a row we've had rain.
It was raining, but it was a bit yuck.
Yeah, I know, right?
But the event itself was dope. I love night racing. I love Qatar. I think it's just one of the best races on the calendar.
No, I think it's a good thing. Was there a lot of people there? Because you didn't really get to see.
It was pretty busy. Pit walk on the Saturday night was pretty full on.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, it's good to see.
So the sport's in a good place. As you said, it's a tight championship. A lot of great riders there.
Yeah. No, I think it's great. I think it's good. We just need some more money in it, don't we?
More money, get the fans involved, whatever that is. You know, maybe we need to look at it from a younger person's eyes, look at Formula One. I'm not saying you can obviously compare the two, but maybe you need just a different way of thinking into the sport to elevate it to what it can be, because Australia traditionally is very engines, mechanical. Look at Bathurst.
Yeah.
You know, you can do the same thing with bikes. Grand Prix still huge.
Yeah, we just need some more innovation somehow. I can't say what, but we need, like you say, we need to change it up a little bit just to boost it.
Yeah, get the personalities out there a bit.
100%.
I think that's probably the big one, and money, obviously.
I think the personality is a good thing. You got to play on that because people either love to love someone or love to hate someone. You know, correct. Like we said before about MotoGP, we haven't got that at the moment.
That's right. And they do have personality. We know quite a few riders now from doing this in the paddock and speaking to them, and they've all got really interesting stories, but they're all different. They think a lot differently, and you speak to these racers and you can tell they're racers. They're not there just to do some laps. Like, they want to win.
No, for sure. Everybody wants to win. That's right.
That's it.
Just how they go about it.
That's it. We love to see it, though.
Yep.
We're here for it.
100%. That's right.
Brent, it's been awesome, mate. Thanks for giving us your time. We have a little present for you as well that we do with all our guests. Thanks to Stacey at HJC Australia. We've got a one-of-one helmet that we are personally signed for you. So when we're big and famous, you can put that next to your Valentino Rossi helmets.
I'm looking forward to that. Yeah. do I keep it under wraps for a little while? You guys are legends. Appreciate that.
No worries.
I can't believe I didn't bring you something.
Oh, just take us to your house after this, please.
A six-pack of Heineken.
That'll do us just fine, mate. Don't worry about that.
I'll give you a roadie if you like.
Yeah, perfect.
Thanks for that, guys. Appreciate it.
But no, we really appreciate, giving us your time and telling us your war stories and your thoughts. So it's been
unreal for us. We were the whole plane right here just very going giddy. Nuts.
Yeah.
I can't believe you guys didn't break it into two parts. No one's going to listen to this for that long.
Man, they got no choice.
Yeah.
Really? Okay. If you guys can put up with me, good on you. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
100% they can. So, it's been awesome. Really appreciate it, mate. And we'll see you around this weekend anyway.
Awesome. Thanks,
guys. Brent. Cheers.
Beautiful. Thanks,
appreciate
guys.
It. See you. Bye.